Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. My name is Ruth McKee and I'm the editor of Books Ireland. Joining me today, I have author Clara Kilroy. She won the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature in 2004 and she's the author of All Summer, Tender Wire, All Names Have Been Changed and The Devil I Know, all published by Faber. And her new book is just out now and it's called Soldier Sailor. Just want to take you back to when you were a little girl.
Yeah.
And just the kind of experiences of books and what you can remember from that time and just any of the sensory experiences or if there's one book that you remember from that period that you could tell us about.
When I think of when the novel became interesting to me, I always say it's quite young, you know, and it was Black Beauty. And it, I still remember being in the back seat of my mother's mini, which had red vinyl seats, and it was sunny, and I was wearing shorts, and it was burning my legs. But I was reading the Bearing Rein chapter in which Ginger, the horse, panics because the Bearing Rein was the thing that used to make their heads arch, and the cruelty of it, you know, and the upset of it. And I was I remember just being hysterical reading this thing. And it taught me empathy, you know, because it gave an animal a voice. That really connected with me. Also, it's first person narration. I never moved away from first person narration. That just clearly, I'm thinking out loud now. That clearly laid that path for me of stories are the voice of whatever it is. It doesn't have to be, obviously I write humans, but it's all about the voice.
That's interesting. I wonder then, because you just said first person and your new novel is first person, and do you ever write in anything else?
Never. Yeah. Never. Now, the thing I'm doing now may have, I'm not even sure, what's it even called? Third person.
Or is it close? Close third person is very, yeah.
I don't want to be too close because actually it's a first person narration in which the first person is narrating the third person. You know, it seems to me that it's about the experience of life for me is so subjective and unknowable that I would find it very hard to pretend I understood what's going on. Mm. And to capture that confusion and flux, I located in the first person narrator, and my narrators are never entirely certain of the world around them and what's going on. I don't trust people who are entirely certain of the world around them and what's going on, because I don't think you can be certain about this world, because it's just full of variables. I could never write an omniscient narrator.
That is interesting. I'm kind of wondering whether, you know, we're talking about the kind of first or the close third person, which is almost really, you still have that kind of, it's kind of hard to put into words for people who do it well. There is still that kind of intimacy and interiority, but and it's not all knowing. There is still that sort of, it's hard to differentiate between the two for me. Whereas in first person, I mean, do you find any kind of limitations with it if you're
Yeah, and you, like, I remember starting my first novel and I'd have the sentences begin with I, and that makes for a poor reading experience. So I remember that I introduced a character called the Conservator, who is narrated through the first person narrator. So he's kind of another type of narration, but he isn't, because he's coming through her. So it you do have to work harder in terms of just variation on the page and good storytelling. You do have to work harder if you're going to stick to one specific way of doing something. Mm. But that's the challenge. And, you know, the one thing that I can say that I've learned from this and continue to learn is that the human imagination will give you ways of getting where you're trying to go, but you have to learn to trust it. And I don't trust it. I'm as insecure as anyone else in that, you know, I look at it and it's not working, it's not working, it's not working. But then sometimes something clicks in and somehow it's presented to you by your brain. You know, it's very hard to codify this, but a solution is presented, but you almost have to corner yourself to get that solution. It's not satisfactory work if you are unable to live with uncertainty. And I hate uncertainty, but it turns out I'm able to live with it.
There you go. Hello, paradox. Yeah. And I mean, sorry, we're going off on tangents here, but you with imagination as well. I was reading an interview recently with yourself. I can't remember where it was. Maybe The Examiner. And you're talking about just that space and time that you need to foster any of that. And that when you're busy, whatever that, I don't like the word busy, but whenever you're full on into motherhood and you just don't, there just isn't that resource. Yeah. You don't have that, so it can't happen.
Yes. Yeah. Well, my experience of motherhood is it's a state of perpetual interruption. And I mean, everyone has a different way of getting this job done. Some people like to go to Starbucks and be in a busy environment. And then Proust needed a cork-lined room. So I am someone who would never go to Starbucks because I need lack of distraction and quietness. So once I had a baby, that was gone.
Yeah.
So I couldn't. The other thing about having a baby, even forget about a novel, finishing a sentence is hard because you're so fried. You're so confused. I remember I was only thinking about this today. Like after I had a cesarean, which meant I couldn't drive for 6 weeks. And then when it was time to drive again, the palaver of get a baby into a car seat, into a car, the car seat connected to blah, blah, blah. I got in the car and I couldn't remember which side of the road to drive on. You know, and now I'm responsible for a baby. And it's that level of bewilderment that was...
That's a brilliant word for it.
Yeah. I think studies will be done on what's actually going on. But for a woman who's been driving all her life to... And I haven't lived in millions of different countries. I've only driven in Ireland. And I literally looked at the road and went, I don't know what side I'm supposed to be. Like, it's just the most disorientating experience. So, yeah, I mean, for me to finish a novel was out of the question. I was trying and trying and trying. Yeah. And I have all these little notes made. And actually, when I went back to compile it into a novel, because I had all these little notes made of when my baby was small, I was able to recall that period of great confusion. Because I jotted bits down, but otherwise, well, it's the other thing, you know,
you've lost it. Yeah, you completely lose it.
You forget the whole day. Yeah. You're like, what did I do today? And it's like, I don't know. Was I on drugs? I can't remember.
Because you've no way. I think as well, you're so sleep deprived, and you're kind of recovering from massive trauma and this huge, amazing tectonic plate change that you just don't have any capacity to recall, or there's just, you're just functioning on a very,
I think it is like your phone. Yeah. So my phone keeps telling me you have no storage left.
Yeah.
And it won't send messages anymore. Yeah. And I think they will study this properly. Because it started happening during COVID. Everyone started going on about brain fog. Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah.
I was like, welcome to my world. But
hello. Yeah.
It's also to do with the fact that it was the same. There were no differentiating future day. And when you have a baby, there are no, like all the dreams sound the same. And all the nappy changes are equally tricky, you know. So it's the same. The landscape is so kind of bland that you can't pick out anything that stands out, you know.
That's so relatable. Everything that you're saying is so relatable. And when I was reading that interview, I was kind of nodding along to it. And I kind of thinking, God, I wish there had been conversations about this at the time. You know, when I had a newborn, you sort of think, God, it is changing. That's great. And I'm glad the conversations are coming out. And hopefully.
Yeah, but we missed the boat.
Yeah, I just kind of. Do you ever keep thinking, God, I've missed it again? You know, keep missing, you know, keep just being too late for things. And then you sound like one of those people going, oh, whenever I did it, wasn't like that, was doing it. I think, but it's true. You know, they're just, and there weren't like, you know, even just like.
Like, Ireland was such an appalling place to have a child before. that I don't look back to mother's or grandmother's times and go, oh, they had it.
No.
Like, oh my God, you could have come out with a rotunda waddle if you know, the brutality back then. So, you know, it is getting better. I am grateful, but I would say by the time I don't know if my child will ever have, I've only one boy. Mm. He won't obviously give birth, but if he ever decided to be a parent or had that opportunity, I think there would be support for women then to a more understanding of what actually happens to your mind.
Yeah.
You know?
And yeah, and what happens to it? Where does it go? When does it return? But you do kind of think of it. Well, I kind of remember it being as a sort of, not that I remember it lifting. It was just a very gradual sort of emergence, really, really gradual, until one day I thought, oh, I feel like myself again.
Yeah.
But it really was like kind of crawling out of it. I don't even know what to describe it. But like, I was laughing when you were right, you said something about, you know, when breastfeeding and writing with the other hand. And I just kind of thought, yeah, I mean, like, really?
Well, you know,
I also remember thinking, you know, oh God, I can't even get up to get a glass of water. You know, I was thinking, oh, well, the water's all the way over there. I'm so exhausted. I think I'll get the water in a second, you know. And then kind of, you know, zoning out again, just, you know, going from those pockets of sleep to sleep to sleep. And you sort of live in that survival mode for so long that it becomes completely normal.
So
you just think, oh, and you say things like, oh, I got 3 hours in a row last night, or, you know. And now I'm looking back on it and thinking, how did I even have a conversation with someone? And like you were saying, about, I don't drive, but you're thinking, God, I was allowed to operate things and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, danger to myself and others, like, just so the idea that you would sort of have some time in the middle of that, just consciousness in the middle of that, to sit down and, okay, I'm going to think of, you know, conceive of a book.
But unfortunately I only decided it about a year ago that I am no longer going to use this as a stick to beat myself with.
Right.
Because I used to go, why can you not write a novel? You know, look at this writer.
Oh, I know. Yeah. So and so.
What's wrong with you? Why are you so lazy? And but women are always, as soon as the guilt, you know, it just gets you. If your career is going really well, you'll feel guilty that you're not with your kids. If your career isn't going really well, you'll feel guilty for, in my case, just guilty that I wasn't writing or writing well or getting anything done. And so it was only last year I went, I'm not beating myself with this stick anymore.
Good.
I wasn't able to write and breastfeed. I wasn't able to write and rock a baby at the same time.
No.
I wasn't able to finish sentences. And there you go.
Yeah. So you weren't, did you manage to read anything during that time? Were you reading, like, in early motherhood at that sort of?
I was reading bits and bobs. I remember reading an Alan Hollinghurst novel. I remember reading Making Babies by Anne Enright. And the only thing I recall of it is the ending, which is amazing because it goes back to her as a young woman and her decision. It's all the baby stuff. I have to say, I can't remember because it was so familiar and I can't remember it, but I remember her. The book is... if I tell the ending, does it ruin the book? I don't know, but I just got to that last chapter and it was the most life-affirming. I hate the word life-affirming because it sounds like such a cliche, but it was the most life-affirming ending of a book I've read, of a decision she made as a young woman based on observation of what was happening to a middle-aged woman, that her life was going to be different. And it was like, yeah! Go on, and you did it. She did it.
Oh,
you know,
awesome.
Her life was different. Yeah, no, it's just that ending that I recall. I remember nothing of the baby stuff.
Right.
I was probably blocking it out, you know, because I was living it at the time. No, your reading life falls apart. It just, like, there's this big gap in my knowledge of the last 10 years, particularly of Irish literature, and they changed hugely, and they changed. It became female, you know, and it was like... I was like, I've missed a bus again. Again. I keep missing that bus. But what to do? I had a baby in my arms. So it did suddenly become female. And I really now, coming out back out into the publishing world, see how different it is. you know, say my publisher, Faber, like it was not that they made me feel small or anything, but I was such a kind of minor operation, and it was a very masculine list. And then first it was Emer McBride, they bought her books. Then Anna Burns won the Booker for them. Then obviously Sally Rooney changed the whole face of it. You know, and there's one more specifically Irish female writer they have who's doing the business for them. Who am I missing?
Is it Audrey?
Audrey McGee.
That's it. Yes.
They suddenly have all these Irish women who are, you know, Sally Rooney's keeping them afloat, you know?
And Una Mannion. Is she favorite?
Una Mannion.
Yeah.
Now we're into my brain not having... she's favorite, isn't she? See, I haven't met these people because I've been gone. I briefly actually met Audrey McGee because Sebastian Barry launched his book in March. And it turned out she hadn't met anyone because she published during pandemic.
Right.
No. Yeah. It's just all like then the pandemic. Sorry.
I know. Forget that as well. Like, oh, yeah. Something happened around 2020. That kind of reminded me of early motherhood as well. That kind of thing. You go for your walk, you come in, you do your thing. It's the afternoon now, and then you do the afternoon things. And then that kind of routine and rhythm to everything was very familiar. You know,
and the
isolation or the you know, that kind of.
Yes.
Although it's hard
to explain. It sounds nice when you describe it like that.
It does, doesn't it?
But when trapped in it. It sounds like, oh, lovely afternoon routine. But when you're like, it was all about how do I get through this day?
Yeah.
Whereas when I was a writer, it was like, oh, God, I'm running out of hours and I haven't got enough words in the page. Got to apply myself. Whereas then when you are in charge of a baby, it's like, can the clock go faster?
Yeah, it is clock watching. It's clock watching, isn't it? Yeah. And your eyes are dropping and you're going to go.
Okay, yeah, all you want is bed.
Yeah. All you think about is sleep. Just literally sleep motivated.
Be on your own. but that's no way to live. Because you go from like doing as much as you can in a day to trying to end the day.
Yeah.
And that's actually the opposite of living. No. Yeah.
No, and you don't realise it's not healthy either. That's the thing you don't realise. Until
I realized.
Did you? Yeah.
This is horrible. I'm being facetious. It's the most it rewires you and re-engineers you, and it's profound. Mm. And that is actually the only reason why you do it.
Yeah.
It is a profound experience.
And you are changed, aren't you? You are completely and utterly changed afterwards. And you're not, I mean, and you think of the things you said beforehand. I remember saying, I actually think I still have the email to somebody where I said something along the lines of, well, I'll be taking 6 weeks off or something. 6 weeks, you know, of course, six weeks when the baby's small. And I said, I hope to use that time to really focus on my writing.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, see, but that's why it needs to be re-understood, though. But it needs to be it needs to be understood. It needs to be supported. You know I'll be able to write while breastfeeding and rocking a cradle. Let's say, and it needs to. On one side, if women knew what was coming, they wouldn't have the baby, which is why they also need to know about the profundity of it.
Yeah,
and how it does rewire you and rewires you in a better way. I think. Less good at some stuff. You're like, I'm like a mansion in other areas of my life where before I was like a shed. So, everyone goes, oh, it's such a surprise, but we're still not preparing for this surprise or supporting this surprise or sharing this surprise. And indeed, men are not enjoying the good parts of it, as in it rewires you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I will live longer for it and live healthier in my own mind because this great love is in my life.
Yeah. And it's that mothering. Give me another word for it. It's not a job. What would you describe it as? You know, because you were saying that, you know, mothers have to mother and generate income. You know, we can't, you know, so to call it a job just doesn't sort of give it enough value to me.
Well, it's not paid.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? It's not. I don't even know.
Yeah. Part of it is, it's not considered work.
Yeah.
you know, that's what you were saying, you'd be able to take that 6 weeks to do other stuff, because motherhood is not considered work. You're going to be sitting around idle.
Watching daytime TV.
That is what the general consensus is, until you do it. And then you realize you've never worked harder in life. You never hopefully will have to work this hard ever again. You will not be paid for this work. You will not be thanked for this work. You will not be recognized for this work. Your child won't remember any of it, because who remembers anything? And there's that aspect, but then there's all the rewiring of the self that happens. That I like to think that Anne Enright said something great to me. I can't remember what stage I was at, whether I'd had the baby, but for a long time after the baby, I really couldn't finish a sentence. I really couldn't finish a sentence and would kind of go, where's the thing? The thing, the thing. You know, I wouldn't be able to find the word for whatever. And it must have been then that I was speaking to her. And part of that was like, Anne, I'll never write again. You know, if I can't speak, if I can't literally follow a conversation, I'm not going to be able to write. And she said, you will be able to write. It's all still there, but it's all going to be completely different. And it was, you know, because it did eventually come out. And it was completely different. The way I write is completely different now.
So tell me about that. Then what is different about it? Is it different genesis? No, it's not different genesis, but it's just coming out differently. Or tell me how that's...
It just comes out. Like, I know when I started on this novel years and years and years and years and years ago, I just used to sit there, and I never did this before ever, but I'd sit there and cry and write and write and cry and cry and write and go get my kid. You know, once we got a creche up and running, that was when he was two. That's when I started working on this novel. And it wasn't sad tears. It was just linked. Like, the imagination was linked to an emotion so big that I was writing and crying at the same time. It's like breastfeeding and writing.
Yeah.
Okay. It was just this emotional experience. So, and I think you could see that all over the book. It's just like, there's this reservoir of tenderness opens up when you're responsible for someone so small. Or indeed, I'd say it's the same for if you're any kind of carer, the world starts looking differently. So I cried and wrote. I should like make an adjective out of it, or a verb, like cried.
Wrote. I croaked my heart out.
I am a crier. It was different, you know, and it was, and like another voice would be going, don't be such a woman. And then the other side is, I am a woman. This is a book about that experience. I don't even want to go woman, mother. I want to go parent, because I want us to move towards men can open themselves up to this too, and they are, you know. One of the main characters is a man, a stay-at-home man, that is, a stay-at-home father. But we can be so much richer if we apply ourselves to this, or open ourselves to it. To crying.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I don't know how to get to that reservoir of crying. I'm not a crier.
Just I wasn't prepared. Crier. No, I will cry at anything. If you show me your dog long enough, I'll start.
I need to get that valve. I'm a tearer upper, but you know, like I'll tear up with lots of things, you know, stupid advert, anything, some random
there
thing.
There you go.
But not actually the good old release of proper crying or sobbing. You know that? No, not for a long time. Love to get there.
If you want to get there, just write about how you feel about your children, you know, or how you feel about someone you're worried about, or you know.
Is it fearful to go to that place? Is it uncomfortable?
No, it's almost like I want my love to outlast me for you. You know what I mean? It's like, I'll start crying.
No, I will tear up. Yeah.
But that's what the impetus was. It's like, it's not enough to go, I love you. I realized, you know, that big rule of writing, show, don't tell.
Sure.
It applies to love. There's no point in going, I love you. You know, you have to show. So there was this kind of like, I want this voice to be here for you when I am not.
Oh, dear God.
That's like, Christ. But that's what it is, because you can't, like, you will have to say goodbye to your babies at some point. You know, that's the deal. And there's no way around that. And actually, that's become a big thing, because I walk around this world. You know, we were talking about our dogs earlier, and I walk my dog, and it's so beautiful at this time of year. And it's like, I'm going to have to say goodbye.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
We all have to say goodbye.
Actually, I can't believe I'm talking to Claire Kilroy talking about something I wrote, but I wrote a little thing about Bear and about having to say goodbye to him. And it's just so sentimental and ridiculous, but I had to write it down. I was like, one day. It's true. And the thing is, because dogs are little ticking grief bombs, you know, it's like a whole thing of preemptive grief. I can barely even enjoy him because I know he's going to die. You know, it's like, oh my God. And I say, well, everyone's going to die. And you just say, okay, let's do it for everybody. One day you're going to die too. So I don't know whether it's this age in life or this stage in life or whatever it is, but you do start sort of saying things and through that lens, don't you? It's just like, oh, well, yeah, the joy of having a dog. But there's
the joy of mortality. But it's beautiful too, because, you know, if it was indefinite, we wouldn't value it. We
wouldn't appreciate it. So
it's a beautiful bind we're in.
So you said something earlier about, I just wanted to ask you about that, about like, you were sort of away in the desert or whatever, figuratively, for 10 years or whatever. And you sort of missed. Do you find you miss or need the company of other writers or hooking up with other writers? You know, the kind of, there's a lot of people who do that and there are people who don't do that. Zadie Smith was one for saying you don't need groups or cliques or clans or workshops or whatever's, you just, you know, it's you and the work. Would you, I'm trying to form a question, I'm just rambling.
My friends supported me. My writer, specifically writer friends, supported me. And it was very important when I felt that I was no longer a writer, and I did for a long time think, if I can't finish a sentence, I'm over. Their friendship and support was of great value to me. So it's not about cliques, it's about people engaged in the same endeavor. So some would have understood it, some of them would not have understood it, but I felt that I was still part of something, if only in a satellite way, but it was meant something great to me. And I did keep up my friendship with like people like John Boyne did very practical things for me. He was sending me books to go try this one, because I was saying I can't read anymore. And he's spoke to me, because he got very upset that I couldn't write. You know, he genuinely got very upset about all this, because, you know, we are friends, but also he's always been supportive of my writing. So I remember him, meeting him in town at his, you're to come in here, we're going to talk about how you're going to get your act together, write a book. And so I went in God, it was a hotel it was quite Celtic Tiger on Pier Street, Trinity something or other, beside a fire station, and we were there looking at Pier Street traffic. And I remember trying to explain to him, look, John, everything's different, I'm not the person I used to be. There was something on the radio this morning about a woman who'd abandoned her baby in a laneway in Rathcoole, and I was like, I know how that happened, I know what was going on, because I was there myself. And he said, there's the beginning of your novel, go home and do that. And I went home and did that, you know, and it was only like his helping me to take the first step, because it's this giant flux. Motherhood is this giant flux. And I did have and had written I had a very strange experience where I got it into my head that to the best thing I could do for my baby, the greatest act of love for my baby, would be to abandon him and let someone else raise him. I had had that, and the logic was impeccable. I'm just like, and I have not had any kind of history of instability, neither before nor since. So it was, I didn't know I was unstable, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it all seemed perfectly logical, and I got sorted. I rang my friend, who is now a novelist herself, Aoife Fitzpatrick. She just published The Redbird Sings, and Aoife rang the perinatal psychiatrist. I got sorted out. Interestingly, I was not depressed. I thought I have really bad postnatal depression because of
Postnatal depression. Yeah.
And he was like, he listened to the story, and he said, "No, you're not depressed. Come back in a fortnight, and we'll chat some more." And the story was just, I'd been to a literary reading, which had been booked while I was still pregnant, and I had no idea what was coming up. And I'd gone to the reading, and I'd had a ball. And when I came back, big fight, chaos, and this logic that the right thing to do was to kill myself so someone could love my child better than I could, and he would not get depressed. So when I came back later, I said, "Well, how did you know I wasn't depressed?" And he said, "Because you had fun." Where is this a case of depression? You can't have fun. You're depressed. But when you were removed from the situation of 24/7, 365,
oh my goodness,
stress and angst and responsibility and exhaustion, when you were removed from that, you were yourself.
You were fine.
Yeah, I was having a great time. I had a great weekend. You know, I saw people. In fact, John Boyne was there, and so he had seen both sides. And just I'd had a wonderful time. I came back and couldn't make the transition from my old life back to my new one. I could, my head fried, like my phone, like all of us not able to finish our sentences or not able to drive our car. Something short circuit. I don't know what it was. And I think in 10, 15, 20 years, they will have a word for it, because they're beginning to study this now that women are finally being studied.
Mm.
But it wasn't postnatal depression because I wasn't depressed.
Really interesting. And I'd never thought of it that way before either, that you take the person out of city. You had fun.
You're not depressed.
I think a lot of people might be able to relate to that. You think, hang on a second, you were smiling and laughing away when you were out in the pub with your friends, and now you...
Exactly.
And why?
I call it in the novel, life is shit depression. It's not postnatal depression, it's life is shit depression, because life is shit. There's no fun, there's nothing to enjoy, and you're so tired and broken. So... Yeah. But it's, don't call it postnatal depression, which is not to say postnatal depression is not a very real and underdiagnosed thing.
But this is a different thing. Yeah.
This is not solved by antidepressants. This is solved by support.
Support. I was going to use that word. That's what's missing. It's support, isn't it? Because if you just someone to come and hold the baby. Yeah, I remember thinking that at the time.
Yeah.
And being jealous of people who had grandparents and friends.
Jealousy.
And a satellite of carers around them.
And
I was like, I don't have anybody.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And then you're like, why are you so nasty? You know, you're a beautiful child. You should be happy. That's it.
Yeah. And you're like, I would just love to go and have a bath, you know, on my own.
I don't think I've had a bath since my 20s.
No, since labor, probably. Yeah.
I don't remember having a bath. It's even really hard to have a shower or
or just prove anything alone, any time, any headspace alone. Yeah.
The jealousy thing.
Oh, yeah. I had that in big spades. And I'd be like, well, the only reason that she looks great today is because her mother took the baby for the weekend and blah, blah, blah. And you do. And it's not a nice feeling either in yourself. And then you're like, oh, my God, I'm turning
into angry at yourself.
Resentful, horrible person, you know, and then you feel even worse.
Yes, it's the other stick. Yeah. There's so many sticks to beat yourself with, and everyone else beats you with a stick if you're a bad mother. So it's just like,
and then that thing, or that thing as well of, you were saying, not being recognised, but people almost, you're sort of underplaying it. Just, oh, I'm just at home with the baby. Yeah. I'm just, you know, there was that sort of, well, what are you doing? Well, and you don't know how to answer it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, the status change, and people do become less interested in you, and it is real. Like, it's you don't want to be egotistical, but when you have, on a very literal level, no value in that you don't get paid for the mothering. You know, now we all, because of the economic environment we're in, we all have to have side hustles, or indeed, I'm talking about my end of things. And women are now the main breadwinner. But so you have to generate something. And actually, that's really good. So only last month, it was after Easter, the weather got good. And this man, I went, oh, this is so nice when the sun comes out. I think I have to retire somewhere warm when I'm old. And he went, retire from what? You don't work. And it's that, you know, everyone thinks this, that you don't work.
Of course.
And yet you're working so hard. You're just not paid or recognized for your work. It's and therefore it's very easy to demean your work, because no one sees your work, which is, you know, part of this book is to write down, this is the work that we are doing, all of it, all of the time, day and night. This is what it is.
On that note, you're going to read for us a little bit from the book, just to finish off, and I'm sure everyone is dying to hear. It's called Soldier Sailor, and it's published by Faber, and you've been listening to the amazing Claire Kilroy.
We were late, and it was my fault. But was it my fault? My husband certainly thought so. He'd been ready all morning, performatively waiting while I got you ready, patiently watching TV, watching football, which was worse. By the time I had you ready, there was no time left for me to get ready. I'd chucked my makeup bag into the glove box. It's 11:20, he had informed me. I am aware of that, I had informed him back, trying to balance the towel on my head as I rushed around, late out of the shower because you wouldn't eat your breakfast. You could help, I had suggested. You could get off the couch and pack the nappy bag. With what? The stuff he needs. What does he need? His stuff, I had repeated by way of explanation. The stuff, you know, all the stuff. But my husband didn't know all the stuff. How would he? Stuff was for the little people. The soother, the spare soother, the nappies, the wipes, the barrier cream, change of clothes, Calpol, a snack, a spare snack for when the first snack was rejected. I tried to say the words, but there were just so many of them that it'd be quicker to pack the bag myself. It's okay, I had sighed, like my mother had sighed before me and hers before her, as I headed upstairs to your bedroom. We're getting later, he had called up from the couch. I know, I had called down from your room. A teddy, a handful of little cars. No doubt the wrong little cars, no doubt the wrong teddy, but anyway. Don't forget the wine, he'd said, without looking up from the screen when I'd reappeared in the living room with dry hair and the bag of stuff. The roar of the crowd in the stadium, a sound that manages to be simultaneously inane and intimidating. Maybe one day you'll explain the male mind to me, sailor. Women don't gather in hordes to hurl abuse at individuals doing an infinitely better job than they ever could. I'd grabbed a bottle from the rack and put it in his hand. He'd frowned at the label. You're not bringing that one, are you? I'd swapped it for another on the rack. All wine bottles look the same to me, sailor, especially when I'm late. There are red bottles and there are white bottles. Some people, generally male people, have the time to study the difference between the two. I'd handed him the new bottle. Acceptable? He'd looked at the label and then up at me. You look great. Have we a bag or something for this? He'd switched off the TV and headed out to wait in the car. I turned to you. Okay, I said in my fake bright voice. Let's go. Off you ran, the Superman cape flowing in your wake. Off I ran after you, Keystone Cops. The front door opened after some minutes. What's the delay? I can't catch him. Do as your mother says, your father bellowed so loudly that you burst into tears. Stop, I said. He isn't well. See, you always undermine me. You gave him his medicine, right? You had tonsillitis again, or had had it. You were over it, but the course of antibiotics still had to be finished. No. Why not? I forgot. But we agreed that would be your job, like your one and only job. And I'm sorry, I forgot. I opened the fridge to get your medicine and found last night's syringe still full. I held it up. Last night's dose is still here. Shit, he said. Sorry. I even measured it out for you. I know. Shit. Sorry. There's no point in apologising to me. It's not me you're harming. Oh, I'm harming my child now? You can't just stop a course of antibiotics. Look at him. He's fine. And to demonstrate your fineness, you shot past with a speed that was impressive, even for you. You had seen the medicine. Yucky! You yelled from under the kitchen table. No! I'll wait in the car, my husband told me, and headed for the door. Thanks for the help, I said to his back. No! You yelled. I put my head in my hands. I don't think I'd put my head in my hands, actually lowered my head into my open hands expressly to block out the sight of the world until I had you. And then, after the protracted negotiations and laborious palaver of getting you medicated, shod, out the door and into the car seat, making us a whole 40 minutes late, a heart-sinking stink reached my nose. I took you back up. He needs a nappy change. To which your father said nothing. It was the way he said it, though.
You've been listening to the wonderful Clara Kilroy, whose novel Soldier Sailor is out now with Faber. Join me next time when I'll be talking to the wonderful Una Mannion. See you all then.